Patrick Tracy, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
No at all. You're welcome, Matt.
I am, like I was saying off air, really, really looking forward to this. This is a conversation I've been very excited about. You have just lived this remarkable, remarkable life. I mean, the kind of big headline things is you were Michael Jackson's doctor. You have been Doctor of the Year multiple times. You've lived all over the world. You've been a part of many historical events around the world, which I'm sure we'll get into. But the place that I really wanted to start and the bit that I'm very curious about is how on earth did you end up smuggling cars into Germany and why? What brought you to that point in your life?
Okay, well, I suppose the first thing, Matt, is that I grew up on the border of Northern Ireland, so there was nothing really unusual about smuggling.
That was a Tuesday night in Fermanagh.
I remember when I grew up, we had a garage and we would have a situation where all the farmers from Bundoran and from Ballyshannon and a lot of Donegal would cross the border up into our garage and they would get tyres put on the cars and we'd, at deck 10 and 11, have an angle grinder and taken off made in the UK on them and we'd be paid with boxes of butter. You know? So when you grow up in that sort of environment, smuggling has a different intonation. Mm-hmm. Why did it happen? Painting windows in Germany wasn't going to get me there, you know. So I came across, I suppose, what technically was a scam, and that was the students in Germany were bringing down old Mercedes to Turkey, and what they were doing was selling them for about four times the price. So the students were financing their way through college. Now, what I did decide to do was scale this up, and we'd move eight cars at a time. So almost in one hit, I had most of the money. But unfortunately, what happened was this. When you went into Turkey, there was a stamp you could put in your passport to say that you had gone into Syria with the car, and then you get another stamp on your passport to say you come back out of Syria, back into Turkey. So a German Zollplatten car, which is one with export plates on it, the Turkish, I suppose, customs could look and say, okay, you've entered Turkey, you've went to Syria and back, and now you've no car, so you sold it in Syria. But unfortunately, what happened just after we had moved eight cars was the guy who had given that stamp actually died. He was 43 and he died of a heart attack. So they waited on the next batch of cars to come in, and they knew that if his stamp was being used, it couldn't have been by him. Somebody had access to a stamp. So I was very lucky from the point of view that the I was the last batch through. Now, we also had a lad, John, from Birmingham, who unfortunately had a rather, I suppose, was loose with his tongue with a couple of beers. And he was telling the locals, you know, about driving down from Germany and selling the cars and that. So they actually had cottoned on to our lot of cars. And I was very, very lucky that sort of I had made my, I suppose, sales just before a lot of the drivers were actually nabbed.
Sure. So you had your Ocean 11s.
I had
heist.
My Ocean 11s.
You had your George Clooney moment. Yeah. And then did you finish school, I assume, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I came back and finished school. But not only that, but when I sort of was paying the guys and sort of I was in the 1982, June the about 17th, and I was in one of the shuks in Istanbul. This rumpus started outside and we had a situation where an Armenian terrorist threw in a hand grenade, killed some people, took out a gun and shot the people, including a young German girl who sort of as much as died before us. So it was almost time to get out of
absolutely
Turkey at that stage, you know.
Crazy.
There are memories from,
yeah.
40 years ago.
This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we interview an interesting person from Northern Ireland who's living and/or working overseas. Now, who are NI Connections? They are the diaspora department of InvestNI, and their mission is really, really simple. It's to connect the Northern Irish community all around the world. They put together some really incredible resources, including how to move you and your family back home if you have been living overseas, how to move to Northern Ireland for the first time, and even how to move your business or open up a new branch in this wonderful place that we call home. You'll also can find hundreds of interviews and profiles with fascinating people who are proud to call this place home, and you can check out all of these things and sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com. Thanks very much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of today's episode.
I mean, you have had multiple brushes since with, I'm going to call it terrorism. You had, and you also had, you've had multiple interesting situations since then in Germany as well. So where would you like to go next? Do you want to take us to Iraq or do you want to take us to Germany?
I don't mind going anywhere. I suppose Iraq is maybe the easiest one. I was in the Ibn Abitur Hospital in 1990. And we were in a situation where Saddam Hussein, as we know now retrospectively, had gassed the Kurds up in Al-Abalya. But at the time, America and Britain blamed Iran for doing it. But when I was at home on March the 18th of 1990, the Sunday Times broke a story saying that it was probably Iraq that did this. Thank God we have very responsible, I suppose, news media and papers, because America would have loved the world to think that it was Iran, which it wasn't really. Even though she had sided with Iran before, you remember Contra deal and all the rest, she then was siding with Iraq in that War of the Cities, which went on for 7 or 8 years. And we were living in Iraq in that period. And when you went to your bedroom at night, there was big X's all over your windows that if a missile strike, that the glass wouldn't come in on your bed. There was like duct tape all over the windows. So the reason that it sort of was of interest to me was the fact that, number one, the Sunday Times had broken that it probably was Iraq, and we were living in Iraq under a very dictatorial regime. The second thing is I had to smuggle back in the Sunday Times because they were searching for papers, because they knew that sort of that had broke. And believe it or not, I was lucky enough to get in a Sunday Times to Baghdad at the time. But we were a tertiary referral center, and at night time I was getting in patients with effectively aplastic anemia and septicemia. So at night time we were in a situation where we were having to spike for blood cultures, and this was going on, you know, at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning for a month or more. When I was covering that aspect, I was doing staff health in the hospital. And they were all from that area of Kurdistan, Sulaimani, Al-Abalya. So, yes, I wandered up into the area some months after that the whole event had happened, just to be there and document it. And now, I've been in a lot of interesting places in my life. It was in Berlin when the wall came down. It was in Soweto during their riots. It was Los Angeles during the riots. So, if you see my memoir, I was in Lebanon when it was invaded. So I've been in a lot of interesting places. Some of them I went to on purpose just to be there, particularly with the fall of the Soviet Union. I was on my way down to Africa, and I went through Moscow and stayed there for 3 or 4 weeks. And when I went up to Al-Habalya, I had to dress as a Kurd, almost like the Peshmerga, to be brought across the mountains. And on our way back, the Iraqi army had sort of sussed us out and arrested us. Now, the thing is that I make no bones about it. My driver, Mohammed, probably never seen the light of day, but that's, I suppose, the way things are or were. And I was in my cell one morning, and I'd been given a year's jail sentence at this stage, but it was just 5 days into it when this colonel came down, sat beside me, put a gun beside me, roughed me up a bit, nothing too bad, just in front of his mates and that, and said, do you think we're all barbarians here? And I said, no. And he turned around and he said to me, I know James Joyce. I know Trinity College in Dublin. Mm. And he said to me, I have cousins who have been to Dublin. And with that, he sort of caught my arm and threw me out the door. And I turned around, and it was quite a walk to where there was freedom in inverted commas. I'd cross a big courtyard, and I wasn't sure, you know, whether it got shot in the back or not. It was one of those situations. And I just turned back and looked at him. He had a very stern face. I remember him still looking out the door at me. And I said, "Can I have my knapsack?" And he stood there for like 3 or 4 minutes just staring at me. And then he left, and then he opened the door and he threw out my knapsack. It was an orange one, and my camera. And they had pictures that I had taken of the oil fields in Kirkuk on the way up, and they thought that I was a spy for Britain or America. And that was what they had sort of held me and arrested me for with, you know, they don't like reporters either, so you're almost better off never mentioning that you're a reporter. And I walked quite a distance to a taxi rank, and then I had, believe it or not, money still with me. And I took a taxi all the way to 700 kilometers back to Baghdad. And I got in contact with a friend of mine because I owed the taxi driver something. I didn't have too much on me. And Chris Duckling, who has died since of a lymphoma, unfortunately, was a friend of mine, brought my stuff. I didn't even go back to the hospital. I flew to Copenhagen. It was the first flight out. And I was playing guitar in an Irish bar 2 days later. Actually, the very next night. And then I was in Dublin 2 nights later, and we went down to the Galway races. I remember that. And that was August the 1st or August the 2nd, 1990. And it went on the TV that he had invaded Kuwait. So I was really extremely lucky from the point of view that all my friends in the hospital, about 450 nurses and doctors, were held as hostages.
We've spoken to hundreds of people on this show.
Yes.
And one of the things that we often talk about is how, you know, being Irish coming from Ireland is a little bit of a superpower. Well, what I'm saying is I've never met someone who can claim being Irish has actually saved their life. Is that man there?
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
James Joyce effectively got you off the hook there.
That's right.
You're just always there.
Grew up in Northern Ireland, what can I say?
How are you always there? That's mad. Yeah. Well, so you say a lot of them have been kind of coincidental, and then some of them have been, you know, you've flown over because you wanted to be a part of it. Where does the desire to be a part of, you know, a historical moment like that come from? What is it about you or your upbringing or who you are just as a person?
I'll tell you a funny story just regarding that. I was in Edinburgh in 1991. I was a member of Christofferin Roundtable. And the guys knew that I was going down to Africa. I'd got a job actually in Johannesburg, I think it was, a urology SHO. But I intended to take 3 or 4 months to drive from Nairobi down to Johannesburg at the time. In the end, I arrived late, so I couldn't take the job. But in the January of that year, I decided to go to Moscow, and it was switching over from the Soviet Union to Russia. So a lot of the soldiers and police had both uniforms on in the transition period. And it was people disagreeing with the transfer, I suppose, of the old communist bloc to a more nationalistic Russia. And I had to be doctor on a trip. We're driving a British Leyland truck, lovely old army truck, and we had about 20 people on that trip, and I was the doctor. And we were going from Kenya to Tanzania to Zambia to Zimbabwe to Mozambique to Botswana, and then to Zimbabwe, and then to South Africa. So it was a lovely trip, and it was going to take us many months, and including some of my wanders, which would sort of keep us going that bit longer. So anyway, I was in Moscow, and it was dire. It was the Moscow of food queues in the shops and all the rest. So I joined one of the food queues, and I met this girl, Olga. She happened to be a doctor, and I stayed in her house with some of her friends. Anyway, I arrived in Mombasa 2 weeks late. So this truck, which was on a 3 month journey, was held over waiting on me to come. Now, the people didn't really mind because they were all lying out on the beach in Tibi Beach, and that whole Indian Ocean side of Kenya is beautiful. I mean, it's just, there's nothing to compare it, maybe except for South Africa or the Indian Ocean, like the Maldives. It's absolutely beautiful. So the guys in the truck didn't really mind, but obviously the guys who were driving it in charge of it were really annoyed, and they were giving me a bollocking. And I had Chris from Melbourne, and David was from Whanganui in New Zealand. And while Chris was there really making a big thing about it all, and I didn't really blame him, but it was worth it to me to live in the Soviet Union in that period. David was out at the balcony of the hotel, and he says, "Oh my God, look at, there's this big string of Mercedes arrived." And he says, "It must be the president." And the president then was Daniel Arap Moi. And I went to stand up like this here. And Chris said, "No, you sit down, you know, like this here. They'll probably pass on." So the next thing is they all arrived outside the hotel. And David says, "No, they're coming here, you know." And Chris was dying to look, but he was dying to give me a bollocking as well, you know. So anyway, when we were there, two guys came up to the room as security and stood at the door we were in. And Chris, you know, sort of gave him and says, "What are you guys doing here? You know, please leave." And David came over and said, "No, it'll be the president. Don't say anything." So anyway, this guy walked into the room. He says, "Is Dr. Patrick Tracy here?"
No way.
Yeah, would you believe it? So I didn't know what to say, you know, because I just had arrived in Africa. I was getting a bollocking, and I didn't want a second bollocking. So I sort of kept my head low, and Chris is looking at me saying, "What have you done, Lucas, here, you know?" And then this sort of Indian guy came into the room, wasn't very tall, maybe about 5'6", 5'7", walked over, smiled at me and says, "Please be upstanding." And that was the code of the round tablers, you know, like this here, because you drank a toast to the Queen and please be upstanding, like this here. And he was head of the whole East African section. That was like Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya, all the British sort of colonies on that East Coast. And they, you know yourself, rule a lot of the economy there, you know. And he turned around, he stood beside me on my left-hand side. And he said to Chris, "Is Patrick in trouble?" So the guys from Kirstorfen had contacted him, believe it or not, you know, and he was head of the round tablers there. And Chris didn't know what to say.
Sure, sure,
because,
sure.
You know, like this here, you know. So he says, "Let me make a gesture, like this here." And Chris is looking at him. He says, "We're going to make a donation to your cause, like this here." And Chris is all ears, listening, yes, seeing that he's down so much money, sitting there for 2 weeks. And he says, "You know the way that there's no good beer outside of Kenya until you reach South Africa?" He says, "We're giving you 24 crates of Tusker beer to put it on the back," because we had a big truck with a big trailer like this here. And Chris saying, and then he takes out a wad of notes and gives him his, and that'll make up for the lost time as well. That's what is wonderful, you know? Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So it's really a combination of your desire to explore and your career that has created this kind of very unique passport that's not only a passport to get you into countries, but also it's been a passport to get you into social circles and relationships and groups that are very, very, very interesting.
Yes. And the funny thing is, you'll know from my books that I respect the pioneers who went before us, particularly in terms of Zimbabwe and South Africa and all the rest. And even though Ireland was colonized itself by the British, I still felt more at home with the remnants of the people who colonized those countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And respected them for what they did. Because, you know, the Protestant Catholic conflict in Northern Ireland, but at the end of the day, it was the Protestant people who came here who built Belfast, who built the sort of industries and all the rest. And it's the same thing when you go to Africa. there was nothing really there beforehand in a lot of these, you know, places where cities were built. And you really got to respect that in many ways. And even though I was in the High Veld in South Africa only a few hours ago, days ago, you know, the whole pictures on the walls that the people have of just two or three generations and their sons went to St. Andrews or Gordonstown, wherever. And there's just something incredible about that period that we're going to lose and it will be gone, you know. Now, it'd be different if, I suppose, these people came and took over somebody else's city, but they built everything that you can see from, you know, Salisbury, which is now Harare, or Bulawayo and Matabele land, you know, the Selborne Hotel. You actually are living through history. So as a writer, I'm often imbued with the memories just of the things around me.
Mm.
And I've always felt that, you know, it's almost like the ancients are talking to you. You know, there's things that I would see walking down a street that some of my friends walking down the same street wouldn't, you know. And it's been, I suppose, a wonderful time to live in that transitionary period when one, I suppose, system is crossing over to another.
Mm.
But and it's funny, I always felt that. And even when I was in Zimbabwe, you know, I'll give you an example. I'm sitting in an hotel. And because I grew up in a garage at home in Garrison in Fermanagh, I would know all the old British cars like the back of my hand, you know, the A40s, the Pininfarinas, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm sitting looking and this farmer has an old A40, you know, and I mean, it was even old when I was there then. That's quite long time ago. So the car probably could have been 30, 40 years old. So I just happened to be, you know, sort of walking out and I said, oh, has it a 998 engine? And his eyes just immediately lit up. And he says, yes. And certainly we were looking under the bonnet and he showed me, you know, like a AC or an SU carburetor he put on it. And then it got round to his son who was in the army, who got killed by ZANU-PF. And he brought me to his grave. And then he brought me to the Matapo Hills, do you know where Cecil Rhodes' grave was? And it's that whole ability to be a traveller and transcend through the ages in a way tourists would never see, mm-hmm. you know. And as you say, like, it's an integration with the people. And I suppose medicine does give you that ticket, particularly with poorer people, that they tend to trust you. You're not, you know, sort of there to take advantage of them. I was in Cape Town in 1998. And I had a colleague, Emma, who I was meeting because I was coming back up to Bray to do a medical job, and she came down to meet me, and I was coming up from Australia, and I dropped her off at the airport up on the N2, and when I came back to get my car, this guy had broken into it, but he was still there, you know, and it was a little Volkswagen Golf I had rented, or they call them a Chico, and he'd broken the side window, and I had bought a Bob Seger tape to play in the tape recorder. So I went and I caught his arm, just bent it up around his back, and he was smaller than me, and he immediately turned around and says, please, mister, don't put me back in jail. He must have thought I was security. I said, what are you trying to do? And he says, I was taken, which technically it was a tape or a CD player. I can't remember if it was Bob Seger, I remember that. And I says, why would you go for that and not like the player? He says, I wouldn't have time. And I just thought about it for a while. The car doesn't belong to me. This guy, you know, sort of is willing to break into a car just to get a bloody CD or a thing, which all he's going to get for maybe is a quid, nothing more, you know. So I says to him, where do you live, you know? I'll drive him home, which I did do, you know. And when I was there, he had a young daughter, 2 years of old, with bad pneumonia. So we got her an antibiotics. And I says, look at me, all you have to do is get my car fixed because I have to leave this back. And within 15 minutes, they put in a little side window and fixed it, you know, and he brought me up to this place and they had loads of ones that were repairing, you know. And that was in the days before, I suppose, where there were carjacking cars, you know. But it's almost that ability to turn, I suppose, adversity into opportunity, and it just opens up another, you know, sort of entry into people's lives, you know. I mean, most people would have reported them, I suppose, and, you know, when you balance it, what are you going to gain, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and,
Was there any?
Don't know where that one came from.
It's good. It's really interesting. Any, you use the word pioneers. If you think about your family of origin.
Yeah.
You know, was there anyone in the family that kind of exhibited any pioneer-like qualities?
Oh, there was.
Was there really?
I had a grandfather who got himself into, I suppose, some sense of political trouble.
Okay. You know,
and had his lands taken from him. But he also was an author and a poet.
Wow.
And a lot of people say that Liam Flaherty's The Informer was actually written by him, you know. So he has some published, I suppose, books back in the 1920s, 1930s, you know. Mm-hmm. But he never talked about it, you know.
Sure. Mm. And
I think they grew up in Derrygonley, close to Garrison in Fermanagh, but he ended up the other side of the border. That was my mother's father.
What is it about yourself that I kind of get the impression, and I mean this with all sincerity and love, you seem to get a little bit of a buzz out of mischief? You like to be in the middle of things whenever things aren't quite going 100% right. Why does that give you a sense of energy, or what does that do for you?
I don't think it's a sense of mischief, Matt. It's more, I suppose, these times will never come this way again. Mm. You know what I mean? And it's just living the moment. So you get an intrinsic sense you're going to come through it and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know, I was in New York 2.5 days after the sort of 9/11, uh-huh. You know, I was supposed to be in New York anyway, but my flight got sort of held up. So it was incredible to be there in John Fitzpatrick's hotel in Manhattan with all the New York Police Department. And they brought us down to Ground Zero and we'd seen everything at the time, just raw, you know. So I don't think it's a sense of mischief. It may sort of be interpreted that way retrospectively by people who don't have access to that sort of environment or situation, you know.
And you said it's the sense of being involved in something that cannot be repeated.
The more you travel, the more you realise that the West isn't exactly the upholder of moral dignity throughout the world. They don't have a moral compass that they believe they have, but the rest of the world don't really see it that way, you know.
Yeah, but the idea of, you know, like a quiet 9-to-5, clock-in, clock-out job is just...
That was never me.
Never?
No.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And you've taken a lot of interest in steps to live a life that is the complete opposite of that.
Well, I think that's fair to say.
What made you leave Northern Ireland? Or why did you leave Northern Ireland, I should say?
Let's say, in the political turmoil of the period, it was safer for me to go to college in Dublin. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a situation, I suppose, where I was president of one of the halls of residence, and there was Union Jacks hung on Senate Hall and a couple other halls, and it was against the Flags Act of the period that had just come in. And somebody hung a tricolour on the top of our hall in Allenbrook, and that kicked off a lot of problems at the time. Nothing to do with me, but I suppose I was president of the hall and I had to sit in at all the meetings. And so people forget that a lot of students were killed in that period. Mm-hmm. I mean, Michael Mackey was hung over the Lagan Bridge with a fishhook, you know. A lot of Catholic students had their throats cut, particularly with Larry Murphy, the Shankill butcher. You know, they would, I suppose, send round false taxis, you know. And it wasn't a nice time in Northern Ireland, and particularly anybody who's involved in student politics, let's be honest about it, you know. The IRA, I suppose, get blamed for a lot of the deaths, quite rightly or whatever. But I mean, from, I suppose, a Catholic student's point of view, it was totally the other way around. We were targeted all the time. Protestant paramilitaries were killed at least five people that I know, you know, for very little. But anyway, things are better now.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you leave, you went to Dublin, and then, I mean, if we skip ahead, your area of expertise in medicine took you to lots of different places, but
yeah,
how did you meet the likes of Michael Jackson and Cary Grant and those types of people?
That's an interesting one. I'd be considered one of the pioneers of aesthetic medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever, I suppose, I started aesthetic medicine, that was not a field of medicine. Even now, it is one of the biggest fields of aesthetic medicine, and it's worth something like $60 billion a year, or was, and growing. At the time, I suppose, there was only cosmetic surgery, and three things came together, Matt. The first thing was Botox came in 1966. Dermal fillers came in 1966 as well, at least the hyaluronic acid ones, and IPL lasers in 1998. Everybody assumes that America started this, but they had very little to do with it, you know. There was myself, I suppose, in Ireland. There was Courthouse Clinics with Patrick in London. There was Rita Rackhouse. So there was a couple of us at that, and we had the first clinics in the world. Mm-hmm. Let's be fair about it. So I would have had a lot of Americans flying into Ireland for hyaluronic acid fillers. Now, it's not so much they were behind us, but the FDA ran trials, and they didn't get using our compounds until about 2004, 2005. And Michael had, Arnie Klein had put some fillers in his face that he wanted removed. He didn't like them. So he was going to meet the Queen at the opening of Casino Royale, and he just didn't like his face. So he came for me to remove them, and we were using a compound called hyaluronidase, and I'm credited being the first person to use it in aesthetic medicine, I suppose, now. So Michael came over, and we removed his hyaluronidase, and then he chickened out and didn't meet the Queen at all.
All that hard work?
Yeah, well, it was sort of hard. And he went over, and I think he was in Claridge's, and took over the whole top floor, and came back disappointed. But I didn't know until later that he hadn't met the Queen, because he didn't really want to talk about it, even though he was looking great.
Yeah.
You know, ish. Yeah.
And so Michael he heard about your work, and he flew over for the procedure?
In the early stages, yes, but then Michael sort of had moved to Ireland then as well. So I remember on the day that we were doing it, he wanted to phone up Arnie Klein, and Carrie Fisher was on the phone first. And looking back now, Carrie's dead, Arnie's dead, Michael's dead.
Mm.
So I'm the only one from that conversation, you know.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes the same with Nelson Mandela and Michael, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were on the phone to Mandela, weren't you?
Mandela was on the phone to me. So what was happening was that Michael was going to do a concert for HIV in South Africa, in Green Park in Cape Town. And he had read some articles that I'd written on the plague of HIV in Africa. And when he came to me first, he had a magazine with his first words were, Dr. Tracy, my name is Michael Jackson, and thank you for all you do for the people of Africa. That was his first two sentences.
Wow.
Yeah. But now that you mention, I suppose, Nelson, I do have an interesting story. We depigmented Michael. Michael had vitiligo, which is an autoimmune disease, where he was black and white. His whole body was black and white. So from, I suppose, his wrists down and his neck up and his ankles, we depigmented him. But that in itself was problematic, because Michael also suffered from lupus. And we also were taking away his melanocytes, leaving him susceptible to skin cancer, particularly basal cell cancer. We'll certainly not go into that now. So if we didn't have to depigment or camouflage, I suppose, the black from the white, except in limited areas, sort of made sense. So I know that a lot of people think that Michael wanted to change his colour because he wanted to change his race, but that isn't true. And Michael should have defended himself more. People would have understood it, just said, look, I've got vitiligo. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we're having this concert and I have got a new compound to try and depigment him, mainly because the hydroquinone we were using, it was leaving him susceptible to other things. So we got this compound from South America called Amelon, and I'm putting it on Michael's leg and it's beginning to go hard, almost like plaster Paris. And I wasn't used to it, and I just didn't know where this was going. Michael's phone rang, and then he turned around and he says, Tracy, it's for you. I said, for me? And he says, yeah. I said, who is it, concert promoter? He says, yeah. I said, I can't take it, you know, like it's here. This bloody stuff's going hard. And he said, no, take it, you know, like it's here. So I'm taking his cell phone and sort of turn around and I said, hi, are you the concert promoter? And he says, no, he says, my son is. And I said, oh, okay. I said, where are you phoning from? And he says, I'm phoning from Cape Town. And I said, oh, I used to live in Cape Town. And he says, where did you live? And I said, I lived in Battery Bay. I lived in Clifton. And he says, oh, he says, I'm just a blow-in. You know South Africa much better than me. I says, oh, so where have you been living then before Cape Town? And Michael looked at me with a big stare and he says, it's my grandfather. I said, your grandfather? He's Madiba. And I didn't know who Madiba was. And he pulled the phone from me. And then I said, fuck, that's Nelson Mandela on the phone. And here's me asking him, where was he living before he was in Cape Town? So I asked Michael, give us the phone back. And he just laughed and he put it in his pocket and he says, he's got Alzheimer's, he'd forget all about it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Africa is quite close to your heart. You've done a lot of, you've done a lot there.
Of what?
A lot of everything. You've lived there, you've worked there, you've done humanitarian work there.
Oh, South Africa?
Yeah, and wider, even beyond South Africa.
I missed your first bit, Matt. You said...
So Africa clearly means a lot to
you. Oh, right, yeah. I have spent, I suppose, most of the last 10 years in and out of Africa.
Hmm.
Yeah, I sort of... we built orphanages in Liberia, Malawi, schools in Uganda, and South Africa, yeah. Africa's wonderful, yeah. Particularly at the level of being able to transition and help people in humanitarian causes, you know. Most of those services are taken over by the church, and I prefer to go down a humanitarian road because I think that that's just another means of control. Substituting one sort of ism for another, if you know what I mean. So I find that medicine and education is maybe more important because it extracts people from poverty in a way that nothing else does, you know.
Yeah, big time. So you've written quite a few books.
I wrote from an early age. I was writing for Fermanagh Herald when I was 13 or 14.
Unreal.
I was a journalist, yeah. And then I wrote for, I suppose, one of the papers in Sydney as well. And then I wrote for a lot of medical magazines, Irish Medical Times, Irish Medical Weekly. So I've always been a writer, but I never really got the opportunity to write much except initially when the Irish recession happened. So I wrote my first book, Behind the Mask. And unfortunately, the publishers went belly up and I got nothing for that book. And it would have been interesting, particularly for the American market, because Barnes & Noble had it, because it mentioned Iraq before the troops went in. And that would have been of interest to the American audience. And also Michael Jackson in a period only about 2 years after he died, you know. So when the COVID happened, I said, okay, I'll make another bang at this. So I updated that memoir 10, 12 years later. And then we were off work for quite a period, 6 or 9 months. So we wrote a lot of books during that period. Yeah, writing tends to come easy to me. I can sit in front of a computer and write for 8 hours straight, you know.
Wow.
Some of the books are medical texts, so I mean, they may need a little more research. And then because I came up with a lot of protocols for treating aesthetic complications, it was easy enough for me to apply them into books. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was it about the aesthetic side of medicine that appealed to you?
Very simply, I would have preferred to have done, I suppose, plastic surgery. Uh-huh. But because I had a delayed entry into medicine, I was always going to be behind. So when the opportunity to put, I suppose, aesthetic medicine together arrived, I sort of came back from Australia when my mum got ill. She eventually died. And I suppose started off the field of aesthetic medicine. And in ways that has been better for me because, excuse me, I'd be recognised as a pioneer with a lot of new techniques that wouldn't have happened with plastic surgery.
Mm.
So particularly, I suppose, the use of hyaluronidase in aesthetic medicine to reverse dermatofibular complications, but also we would have been in early with HIV lipodystrophy, putting in facial implants. The protocols for chronic migraine, you know, and I was lecturing about that 22 years ago, you know, when it was only passed as a procedure that was accepted by the MRHA and the FDA in 2010, you know, 9-10 years later, you know.
And now, what's in front of you?
I'm in an interesting place now, I suppose, because I'm cutting back my work to about 2 or 3 days a week. So that widens up the possibility of doing other things. So I'm going to transition into more giving motivation or inspirational talks.
Mm-hmm.
I've already been asked to give a talk in Paris on February the 1st to 3rd, that sort of period, and then in Glasgow sometime around the end of March. And the title of my talk is Don't Give Up on Your Dreams. I already had done a TED talk on this. And a lot of it is the basis, I suppose, of the second book, The Needle and the Damage Done. And my books are usually named after songs by one of them by Michael Jackson, one of them by Neil Young, obviously. And I sing and play guitar myself, and I have sung some Neil Young along with some of the chorus in the Royal Society of Medicine. And so that'll be a new phase, you know. I've done my bit in terms of lecturing around the world in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So now it sort of gives me something to get up in the morning and work at, you know.
Sure.
I started a recent group on aesthetic medicine on LinkedIn, and it's already got 4,000 doctors on it.
Nice.
So that's a big, you know, sort of commitment, but it also is easy enough for me to do,
yeah,
because I've written all the books, so I have a lot of the data there, yeah, you know. Probably destroy my own book sales, but anyway.
Well, you're contributing. It is interesting, you know, in your career, you have not only touched a lot of patients' lives directly, but you've also mentored and trained.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, thousands of doctors at this stage.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the ripple impact of that is quite remarkable.
Yeah, and I've got visiting professorships of dermatology in some places like Pakistan and that, and Australia recently gave me a big award, an honorary fellowship in cosmetic surgery. So, yeah, you can, I suppose, see that when you go there.
Mm.
I was recently in Azerbaijan in Baku, and this young girl, 15, blagged away into the conference as a volunteer, and she wanted to meet me and she wanted to do medicine, like this here, you know. And it's amazing when you see, and I'll show you a video for later, you know, that sort of influence on people that you have never met or
sure,
you don't know, you know. Yeah. On the way up in the train this morning, I got two problems, one from Russia and one from, I think it's Armenia, you know. And a lot of these people with problems have nobody really to turn to. And yeah, it's amazing. You're thinking to yourself, how can a 15-year-old girl in Baku blag away to a conference just with one of my books
yeah.
to get it signed.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
It's remarkable.
It is remarkable, yeah.
If you could go out for a coffee with anyone dead or alive from this part of the world, who would you take and where would you take them?
Somebody mentioned that earlier. Because I'm back up from Uganda not that long ago, and a friend of mine just left from South Africa to Uganda because we were building, I suppose, schools there. One of my colleagues, who's Dennis Burkett, who I suppose was a military captain with the British Army in the period, I suppose, during the 1950s, and when Britain still had a lot of its colonies in Somalia, Uganda, and just had lost India. I suppose Dennis went there, and I met his daughter Judith in Enniskillen there recently. He went to Portora, so he went to college or school in Enniskillen like myself. He then studied medicine in Dublin, albeit Trinity, I did RCSI. But when he went there, he noted that children's cancers of their throat and of their neck were limited to certain areas of a certain height above sea level, where the cert appeared and disappeared, and he correctly surmised that the vector must be something like an arthropod, like malaria or like mosquito, because its vector was only geographically limited to certain areas. So if you put the map of the cancer and the map of, I suppose, malaria, the common vector was mosquito. And he introduced me to Trexate, I suppose, for the first time, and it worked in these tumors. And I was in a situation where I had a lot of nodules from derma fillers in the post-COVID vaccine period that nobody could resolve. We had 23 of them. I handled them in Dublin or on the internet, and we used methotrexate for the first time, and it worked in 22 of the cases of a 3-month period. So there's Dennis, both of us in Enniskillen, both of us went to college there, both of us went to college in Dublin, sorry, high school there, both of us went to college in Dublin. We both were in Uganda, Makira, in the same area, and we both used methotrexate for the first time to solve a problem that the world couldn't solve.
Wow.
You know, so the similarities are there. So it'd be nice to meet Dennis for sure, you know, and that was the first time methotrexate was used on dermal filler nodules, and I'll be speaking about that in Paris in a few weeks' time.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
We have a closing tradition, Patrick, and it's very, very simple. It's this. If you could go back in time to a 18-year-old version of yourself and you had a couple of minutes of time with an 18-year-old Patrick, what sort of things would you say to him?
Keep doing what you're doing. I've sort of made one or two mistakes along the way, as most people have, and I probably would, at the risk of not mentioning them, tell me to make slightly different decisions.
Sure. Awesome. Patrick, thank you very, very much for your time. I've really, really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you coming in to see us. Amazing stuff. Just want to give one final thanks to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. You can sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com, where you'll get straight to your inbox interesting stories from people who are from this place but are living and working overseas. You'll also get some really interesting insider information about best practices of how to move back home or how to start a business here and all this other really, really interesting stuff. niconnections.com is the place to do that, and we're so, so grateful that we're able to keep this series going thanks to NI Connections support. Have a great rest of your day, and thank you so much for checking out the podcast. Cheers.